our next guest and for the remainder of the program. This man is something else. This is Jonathan Zapp. He is a photographer, an author, a teacher, a paranormal researcher, and a philosopher who has written extensively on psychology, contemporary mythology. He's worked as a staff gemologist and instructor for the Gemological Institute of America. He has taught English in high school and college, worked with troubled youths as the dean of a South Bronx high school. As a wilderness guide, he has led inner city kids and other young people on expeditions to remote desert canyons and to the summit of Mount Rainier. He's the author of numerous published articles, essays, experimental works of fiction, and the Zapp Oracle. His most recent work is Crossing the Event Horizon, the Singularity Archetype. Jonathan has an extensive background in Jungian psychology. That's Carl Jung, rational man. Paranormal research and dream interpretation. For over 30 years, he's been using the tools of Jungian psychology to study popular culture, contemporary mythology, and dreams for evidence that we are getting signals from the collective unconscious about the nature of a quantum evolutionary event approaching the human species. Tonight, well, we just finished with Dr. Hart, and we talked about stupid. Now we're going to get into Crazy with Jonathan Zapp on Coast to Coast AM. Coming to you at the speed of light, welcome onto the bridge, Jonathan Zapp. Sir, you must be 90 years old to have done all of that stuff. How is it you're up at this hour?
Well, it's amazing what energy drinks and adrenaline and knowing that millions of people are listening to you can do for your alertness.
That's for sure. You have had an amazing career. And where shall we start? Shall we start with the, your book, Crossing the Event Horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this book and how does it dovetail into tonight's discussion about psychopathy or psychopathy?
It does. Your guest was talking about information. He was kind of from a more information person's point of view, talking about the same kind of thing that I do, which is the collective consciousness. And the book is about something happening in the collective unconscious and consciousness called the singularity archetype. And just very briefly, just so that people understand what an archetype is, a classic familiar example is the hero. Like Joseph Campbell wrote a famous book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Because the hero turns up in every culture. It's not something that people just inherited by hearing it or reading it. It's just sort of inside of us in an irreducible way, so that no matter where you grew up, the hero turns up as a primordial image and idea. And the hero in all these different cultures will also go through these different phases, like the call to adventure, the refusal, the descent into darkness, and so forth. So we tend to think of our minds in the Western world in a somewhat naive way, as if it's born like this blank slate, and then it's kind of booted up by culture and by, you know, cereal box tops and things said on TV and so forth. But actually, you know, some young girl, and this has been recorded by Jung and many others, might have dreams that are just thick with imagery from ancient Egypt that she had no exposure to. So our minds tap into a field of knowledge and consciousness that is more than our individual experience, and that's been proven empirically. Jung demonstrated it, when you have something that can occur in such incredibly exact forms in so many different cultures that even had no contact with each other, that tells you something, and it tells you that there are archetypes. And the singularity archetype is an archetype I feel I've discovered, though there's some other Jungians that have had some parallel insights, particularly a philosopher named Michael Grosso, who I only discovered after writing the book, actually. But the singularity archetype is like this primordial thought form in the collective unconscious about the future of our species, about a template for metamorphosis. And it does not tell us times or dates. It doesn't do things like that. It's the sort of thing where you look at it through many different eyes, through many different dreams, and so forth, and you kind of strip away the noise, which would be any things peculiar to just one version, any idiosyncrasies that might happen because of a religious tradition or whatever. And then you kind of get to that signal which is the archetype itself. You never get it perfect, but you get this impression of it after you've experienced it. And of course, I give many examples in the book so that the listeners can do that themselves. But this is not like something happening outside us to look at from the outside. It's also happening inside of us. And that's why they say archetypes are not just objects, they're subjects. They're living agencies that have a kind of intelligence and that shape culture and shape us. And the singularity archetype, which I've discovered, you know, occurring in many people's dreams. Other people have found it, recorded examples of that. I'll give one in a moment. It turns up in science fiction movies and fantasies. It turns up everywhere. It's ever present. It's as ubiquitous as Wi-Fi and that kind of thing in the air. And it gives us a template for how our metamorphosis is going to go. And one of the aspects of, well, I'll just give you a really quick example to ground this in a dream. This was one recorded by, not me, but Marie-Louise von Franz, a wonderful woman who is one of Jung's greatest colleagues. And this is in a book called Man and His Symbols by Carl Jung and some of his colleagues. And this was a woman she described as a simple Protestant woman. And she had two very arresting dreams that like shifted her, you know, to her depths. And in the first dream that we'll look at, it seems like apocalypse, and the singularity archetype is very related to apocalypse, that they overlap strongly. The dark wing of Satan comes down in her dreams. It seems to touch the earth in the Middle East, and she's standing there on the earth with a guide looking at it, and it's terrifying, like the coming of the Antichrist. In the second dream, however, she's seeing exactly the same event, but what looked like the dark wing of Satan, now she's up in the heavens, and she's observing it from a higher vantage. And what looked like the dark wing of Satan is now revealed to be the white wafting cloak of God. And she draws a white spiral of light in the sky and the figure of Jesus reaching out toward mankind. And the von Franz describes it the way the spiral is oriented, and people will see a spiral oriented that way on the cover of my book if they go on my website. It seems to be calling the viewer into another dimension. And so this is a very concise version of the singularity archetype. Something will happen that from the ego point of view, the dreamer standing on the earth, will seem like Armageddon, apocalypse, the worst thing possible. But it will be revealed from a cosmic viewpoint to be a transcendent evolutionary event. And so it has this dual aspect depending on how you look at it. And it relates to the psychopathy subject in a number of ways. One is that apocalypse is a Greek word that means to uncover or unveil. And one of the things that we're going through the apocalypse in a sense right now, because right now, and especially since this meltdown, there's been a real unveiling. A lot of people were kind of asleep in a certain way because when the economy is good and people have all their serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors in their hot pockets and their cable TV, they don't necessarily try and look behind the Wizard of Oz's curtains. But when all those things are taken away and all the comforts are taken away, people start to wake up and try and uncover what's going on. And we are getting an uncovering. And one of those uncoverings relates to condition of psychopathy, the condition of being a psychopath. We're suddenly discovering, especially with the financial meltdown, that this is something that's not just some dusty psychiatric label. It's not something that's just about slasher movies like people will think of Anthony Perkins and Psycho and this kind of thing. It's something that is much more central to human experience and to the experience of history that we're going through right now. So Stephen Dedalus, a James Joyce character, said, "History is the nightmare from which I'm trying to awaken." And we are trying to awaken from it right now. It may seem like things are darker than they have been before, but that's only, you know, if your sense of history doesn't go very far back. If you think back to World War II, for example, things seemed a lot darker. But there's a real awakening going on right now of, like, what is it that, who are the puppet masters? What's been pulling our strings? What's been creating history as a nightmare? And one of those things is that there is a subspecies of Homo sapiens called psychopaths. And this is not just my idea, but a number of evolutionary biologists have suggested that they are a subspecies. And these are people, about 1% of the population, and this is a fascinating thing that suggests this awakening in the collective unconscious, is the focus on the 1% and the 99%.
Yes.
And a number of people have criticized that, and they said, well, really, it's not. It's really like, you know, more like 0.01% or something like that. But
yes.
This is the thought form, you know, thinking back to George Hart and the information. This is a meme that's very powerful right now, a unit of information lighting up in the collective consciousness, the 1% and the 99%. Well, it just so happens that 1% of the population are psychopaths. And so I think... beneath, you know, often people say things that have more layers of meaning than they realize. And I think that, and that's true for the collective consciousness as well. So this whole thing about the sudden focus on the 99% and the 1%, I think is also an awakening to the realization of psychopathy, which has been a force, a devastating force in human history. If we were to like look back in history with like a highlighter, and suddenly I could highlight everything related to psychopathy, and we'd see there's George, there's Stalin, there's you know, the whole Nazi period. We'd see all these different things, including the financial meltdown, and psychopaths. It's not a completely new idea. In fact, Theophrastus, a student of Aristotle, wrote a study of psychopaths called the unscrupulous man, and he describes all the same things that we observe today. Other cultures have recognized it. There's a particular Eskimo group that call them the Kunla Genta, and they describe a sort of man who would sleep with many women when he wasn't supposed to and would not was constantly getting reprimanded by the elders, but it didn't seem to faze him. And an anthropologist asked one of them, well, what would you do if you discovered you had a Kunla Genta in your midst? And one of them said, well, when no one was looking, we just push him off the ice. So this is something that has been recognized for quite a while, but we now have more information than we ever had before. For example, now that we have functional MRI scans, we've discovered something really objectively different about psychopaths that matches up with what we thought we knew about them. And that is that psychopaths are without emotion as we conventionally experience it, or as normal people experience it. This turns up in the fMRI scans because if you show people upsetting content in the form of an image or a word that has a lot of highly charged emotion, like rape or something, then for most people, the 99%, the limbic part of their brain lights up. It's a part of the brain that's associated with emotion. It doesn't light up with psychopaths.
Oh, dear.
The only part of what lights up is a part that's just associated with linguistic processing. So to them, what for us would have high emotional content, to them is just one more thing in the environment. You know, I'm walking around, there's a rusting transmission, there's a person writhing in agony, there's an overturned garbage can. It's all the same. And this is something that's very hard to, it's easy to express this, but it's actually very hard for us to grasp this. And the reason why it's so hard to grasp it is because for most people, emotion is so much a part of the texture of every moment. And you know, we may have dogs, and we can completely recognize emotions in them and in many other mammals. So the idea that another human being who looks just like us and may actually be the most charming and likable person you've ever met does not have emotions as we experience them is a very hard thing to grasp. What they do have are proto-emotions, like rage and frustration and that kind of thing. And what got me going on this whole subject in relationship to the meltdown, and I never thought I would get into the subject because I don't see myself as really much of an economist, but Alan Greenspan was giving testimony in front of Congress, kind of a little bit of a mea culpa because many people held him responsible, you know, and that he had contributed to things going wrong at his watch. And he admitted a fundamental mistake. And what he said was, in Greenspanese, I don't know if I can remember it verbatim, but he said, "I came to recognize a flaw in my model. I assumed that self-interest would keep people from doing certain things." And when he said that, I suddenly realized, okay, what he's really saying is something that's very close to my whole point of view, is psychology. The economy is a function of the human psyche. Money is just the symbolic artifact that exists or that has power because of the human psyche. It is the human psychology that drives warfare, environmental pollution, and everything. And usually we talk about more superficial causes. Well, it's because the banks did blah, 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 blah. When you get to the bottom of all of it, it's because of the psyche. And that was Jung's great insight. And he also said, and that is our great danger. You know, as Jung once said, you know, there is no such thing in nature as an H-bomb. That is man's doing. That's a product of psyche. And what he said, also, the content of it was a very interesting observation and that had a connection to psychopathy that Alan Greenspan did not seem to see. Because one of the things about psychopaths who are not considered mentally ill, they don't have delusions, they're more coldly rational than the average person. But they do not, because they don't have regular emotions, the only way they can often feel anything is to have excitement and to take risks. And this is the one area where they will be irrational, or where they will usually do everything looking out for number one in their self-interest. Where they will compromise that frequently is to get that adrenaline rush. And that was part of what was going on with the meltdown, is people were taking crazy risks that would bring down the very food, you know, cycle that they were part of, and yet they did it anyway because they just loved the thrill of it.
Adrenaline junkie, so to speak. Would you mind, Jonathan, just restating that comment that you made about money and what money actually is? It's the lubricant behind what these people do. It's not the objective.
Money is really an exteriorization of the human psyche, and it's related to magic and to psychology and energy. And if you look at a dollar bill, you can just see all the spells and symbols and glyphs.
Oh, yes.
Into it. It's clearly a magical artifact. And so everything that we're facing, except, you know, maybe for, you know, the occasional errant asteroid or CMEs from the sun, it's all the product of human psychology. And we, you know, looking into the depths of it can be like looking through a glass darkly. But if we keep our heads about us and use certain techniques that Jung developed, we can find out some very interesting things about what's really going on and not mistake symptoms for causes.
Well, so it does appear that we all travel the same road, but not all of us see the same scenery.
Exactly. And this is such a hard thing for us to wrap our minds around, that there are people who can be seeing things so differently than us. We're usually encouraged to see how people are alike and so forth, but there could be a group of people that's extremely different. And this doesn't mean that we don't have darkness in our own hearts and that there's just one group of the bad people and, you know, everybody else gets off the hook here. That's a subtle danger in learning about psychopathy. But it does mean that there are people in our midst who are perfectly camouflaged, so that even Bob Hare, the world's leading expert on psychopathy, who created the psychopathy checklist, the state-of-the-art tool for diagnosing psychopathy, says it could take him 6 months to a year to detect whether somebody is a psychopath.
He described unbelievable. This is something else. This is absolutely fascinating. Delighted to have you with us on the program tonight. Jonathan Zapf, we will get into all things psycho and the ramifications for our civilization, or whatever you might call it, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Yes, indeed. Jonathan Zapf is our guest tonight for the final 3 hours. We will find out just how many psychopaths have been running things. Sounds to me like it could be Napoleon, the Caesars, King Herod. Pick one. Stand by for 2 minutes. We shall return with Mr. Zapf on Coast to Coast AM. John B. in with you for the night. And Jonathan Zapf, where does this... You know, there was recently a story where anthropologists had determined that those people that we know of as modern humans, however modern it might have been back when the Neanderthals shall we say, cross-pollinated with them. So if you say, you know, that guy over there, he's a real Neanderthal. Well, according to scientific research released recently, he might actually be part Neanderthal. Where does this psychopathy come from? Is it, it's not like Terminator, the robot who has no emotions, because some of these people are quite charming. So I suppose that's the real danger. They appear to be normal, but they are not.
Exactly. Well, kind of like the T-1000 Terminator, that like the devil that has the power to assume a pleasing form. So they say, don't think of Hannibal Lecter, think of Hugh Grant. And I've had some run-ins with psychopaths, and they're often like the last person you would ever worry about. But I was really fascinated to hear what you said about Neanderthals, because it kind of sparked something in my mind that may be related to psychopathy, in that anthropologists also believe that, or it at least looks like it's quite possible that, because we are the last hominid species standing, and we now know there was a substantial period of time when Neanderthals and Homo sapiens and some other hominid species apparently all walked the earth at the same time. But we're the last man standing, and one idea is because we killed off the competition. And that's you could see why that would happen. It's like we're all human beings are, you know, technically considered predators, and so there'd be a natural, and we're also like the cutting edge of evolution on this planet. We are the dominant species, we are the apex predator. And so if there is any competing hominids that look just similar to us, but maybe didn't quite have our fast neural processing or something, we might want to kill off the competition. And this principle, this sort of psychopathic ruthless principle, or the principles of predation and parasitism, which we see throughout nature, continue in us. And we're a homicidal species. And so what we did to the Neanderthals, you know, our collective psychopathy, may have very deep roots. However, it may also even serve positive evolutionary purposes. I'll get into that a bit later, perhaps. But, you know, this is a key part of human destiny, is that we have those amongst us who are really not like us, but yet they're perfectly camouflaged.
Well, are you recognizing symptoms in any luminaries currently in our political or banking system that might appear on television from time to time, or should we leave that out of the equation for the moment?
Well, it's tempting, of course.
Isn't it?
It is. There are certainly people who show psychopathic symptoms, and I think, you know, we can I'll probably think of a lot of the same people. There were a number in the Bush administration, for example. But it is kind of dangerous, of course, to try and diagnose people from afar. The world's leading authority, Bob Hare, says he wouldn't try and do that because you really need proximity and all that kind of thing. But there are certainly people who've done and said things and acted in ways that are highly suggestive of it. People have said that even about George W. Bush, because he had a history of blowing up bullfrogs with firecrackers when he was young, and some other things that he would say would sort of show a lack of affect, or like some of the slips where he'd say, like, we need people to have enough money so they can put food on their family, like it's
yes.
Just a very abstract thing for him. On the other hand, you know, I've heard some countervailing evidence. I've heard that, like, what he would speak to some of the parents of soldiers who died in the war and get very emotional with them, and it seems quite authentic. Now, psychopaths could be great at feigning emotion, but you would think that he would be better at doing that in public and wouldn't waste that on, like, you know, obscure private citizens. So who knows? You know, I don't want to do that from afar, but what we can see is signs of psychopathic culture. And in addition to the term psychopath, there's a confusion of terms with the subject. Like there's sociopaths, and then they create an even more confusing category, antisocial personality disorder. And as the syllables multiply, I think George Carlin talked about this. We went from like shell shock in World War I to battle fatigue to post-traumatic stress disorder. And as these bloodless syllables multiply, we kind of lose touch with the reality of what we're talking about through this abstraction. And one of the most memorable things my writing mentor at NYU, a novelist E.L. Doctorow, once said, he called these psychiatric labels the industrialized form of storytelling. Very important we keep that in mind, because other people would say that these are the villains or the demon-possessed people or whatever. And sometimes the mythological labels wake us up a little bit more than the bloodless clinical ones that sound like, oh, there must be a pill for that. And there isn't, because psychopathy is not an illness. It seems to be actually a very successful biological adaptation. And evolutionary biologists, that's why they consider it a subspecies, that if you have a species where most people are inhibited by conscience and you're not, well, you have a number of huge advantages in winning power struggles. And so what a number of people have noticed, including Bob Hare, the world's leading expert, is that psychopaths are drawn to where the power, the energy, and the risky, high-stakes, high-octane environments are. And remembering that, you know, there's more I want to say about parasitism later. You know, they are parasites quite often, and they go where the energy is. And so, you know, we think of psychopaths conventionally, we think of the low-functioning ones, the ones that get caught, the ones that do stupid things and go to jail. Those are the Neanderthals of the psychopaths. The other ones are like world leaders and running economies. And even as recent as 2010, Bob Hare finally got to do a study of highly successful business types, and he did find that some of them had amazingly high scores on the psychopathy checklist, some of the highest he's seen. Because you got to remember that psychopaths have all the qualities that a good human resources person is looking for in a candidate for an executive position: decisiveness, high confidence, charm. They don't hesitate, and so forth. They are often the most popular people with men and women, but particularly with women, and there are more male psychopaths than female. And they are very charismatic and are very good at getting themselves, much better than the average person, at getting themselves into a position of total power, where having a conscience could be a disadvantage to keep you from following, you know, Machiavelli's techniques and this kind of thing, and where your confidence and charisma can really mesmerize people. And I want to say a little bit about the charisma of the psychopath. Some have suggested that it has biological origins. Many people, including professionals, a significant percentage, will feel like their heart rate accelerating and their whole nervous system buzzing in the presence of a psychopath. And they theorize it could be an instinctive response to a predator, that you sense you're dealing with a predator and that keys up your nervous system. Well, for some, we glamorize, we were attracted to predators. I mean, what is as beautiful as a big cat? They're fascinating. And there's a way in which cats sometimes almost seem to hypnotize their prey. And so these can be fascinating, charismatic people. That women in particular can get a kind of alpha feeling from them because of their total confidence. And like Ted Bundy, who may have murdered as many as 100 women, got all kinds of marriage proposals in prison. And we know that serial killers and other like outrageously psychopathic people will have this, you know, will become the prison sweethearts of some women. And this is a disturbing thing because psychopaths are also more sexually active than the average person, and they're better at impregnating women. It does seem to have a genetic component. It's not 100%, of course, nothing is, but at least probably as strong as schizophrenia in identical twin studies. If one identical twin is a psychopath, it's much more likely the other one will be, but it's not a guarantee. So there seem to be other factors. You know, it may be more like you inherit a proclivity toward it, and then other things may trigger it or not trigger it. Like it doesn't get triggered as much as in Asian cultures, where there's a strong emphasis on collectivity and individuality is not as culturally supported. So the psychopaths are able to infiltrate. They're considered the perfect predator. Because of all these abilities. And I have a personal theory about the charisma, or a way of explaining it, and I'm just going to Mitch, I think it's important, but also because most of what I'm saying about psychopathy is stuff that you could get elsewhere, but this is a particular theory I have about explaining a way of explaining the charisma. So if you think about why people are attracted to charismatic people, what's causing most people to be unhappy is something psychologists call psychic entropy. And it's these sort of repetitious looping thoughts. I'm no good. What if this happens? And so forth. This is what's going on in people's minds. And especially if they're by themselves, that's why all the psychopathologies like eating disorder, you know, behavior and so forth happen more when people are alone. Because if other people are filling your head with their talk, you have less of this psychic entropy. So this is what people are trying to get away from, that terrible inner confusion that they have and all that chaotic, fragmented stuff going on in their mind. And now a psychopath comes up, and if you think of their mind as like iron filings scattered on a piece of paper, now when a psychopath approaches, it's like putting a magnet under that piece of paper, and now suddenly all the filings get organized into this definite pattern. They can have such single-pointed focus, because when you don't have regular emotions, they just have the proto-emotions of like rage, fear, and so forth, reptilian sort of emotions. You don't have the inner conflict. Also, they don't have shame. They don't feel there's anything wrong with them. This is why it's different from a neurosis or like a mental disorder. Like with a neurotic, they have symptoms that are called, it's kind of a clinical word, but ego dystonic. That means that like their ego, their waking personality, doesn't like them. They know they're unhappy. They know they're anxious. They might seek out therapy. But psychopathy is a character disorder, and it's ego systonic. They are high on themselves. They have no doubts about what they're doing. And it's like somebody once compared the neuroses, you know, the neurotic is great at making themselves miserable, but the character disorder person, like the psychopath, is great at making everybody else miserable. So when somebody has one-pointed focus and they're totally congruent and they have total confidence and they've also become an expert at reading you and camouflaging emotions to serve their purposes, you have like a predator that can hypnotize the prey. And there's another aspect of this that I wanted to mention. Let's see. This is just another little theory I have. I'm mentioning it because it's not to be found elsewhere. At least I couldn't find it elsewhere. One thing that I found in the literature was confusing, they didn't explain well, was why psychopaths were so good at reading people. Everyone says this. They're great. They'll know your weakness and vulnerability immediately. But what they didn't quite explain is, well, it would seem like psychopaths would be very lacking in emotional intelligence because they don't have ordinary emotions. Why would that make them good at, why wouldn't that make them more like an Asperger's person or something like that? And what I think it is that because they don't have because their psyches aren't filled with emotion, they can read you more cleanly like a clean photographic plate. See, most of us, because we're filled with our own emotions and our own emotional needs, we look at another person like, does he like me? Does he not? You know, and all this other, and it clouds our ability to read other people because we're so busy processing our own emotions. But if you don't have emotions, then the emotions of other people can be read very objectively in a very cold and accurate way.
Jonathan, let's clear this off the table. Now, you know, we're going to follow a little bit of form here because you and I have a lot to discuss. But let's take care of this, the political aspect of this for a second. And we picked on George Bush a little bit, and that's fine. But you know, based on what you have to understand that no matter what I say as the host, someone is not going to like it. I mean, I am alternately right wing, left wing, Zionist, and Nazi. It just depends on what fragment, what little soundbite came out at the moment, and that can send somebody into a wrong impression land.
John, I've heard many shows, and I've heard that, and that it's an accurate self-description, and it makes you perfect for Coast to Coast because
Coast
is like a beacon of novelty, and the fact that you're unpredictable goes right with that.
Well, the thing about it is that based on the criteria that I just heard, it sounds like you described our current commander-in-chief perfectly, completely confident in what he's doing, charismatic, goes right on down the road, is not deviated from the path that he's chosen to take. So, I mean, is it that we're dealing with the entire bunch of bloody psychos because they're all drawn to the power, whether they're White House pages hoping for more power, or whether they're in the Congress or in the judicial branch or the executive branch. I mean, are we just like infested with psychopaths?
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, because and I had a feeling this was going to come up in a certain way, because this is a kind of a key danger in you know, the knowledge about psychopaths can, like all knowledge, can be a sword that cuts both ways. So but let's take it from the top, like Obama, for example. Now, again, you know, he could be the most cold-blooded but most brilliant black magician of all time, and so forth. I would say, though, the thing that most strongly points away from that for me, especially as an English person who's pretty good at reading text, is I very carefully read his books. And I don't think somebody who lacked affect, who did not have a regular emotional life, could write those books. So I don't read him as a psychopath. He may have all kinds of other flaws. And this is a key point, is we want to be careful about a certain type of shadow projection where it's like the psychopaths versus us. There are a number of flaws in that. It's kind of a paradox in a certain way, because on one hand, a dualistic position is justified in their case. They can be objectively different. It can even be measured. Maybe we should even, you know, demand or pressure politicians to, you know, show us their functional MRI scans and this kind of thing. It's something we could get into later on, like what we could do about this. But on the other hand, people who are not psychopaths, the 99%, including you and me, can also do terrible things. And so, therefore, not everybody doing bad things is a psychopath. Also, I created a term, situational psychopathy. And what that is that when a person who's not a psychopath enters a psychopathic culture, they will act in psychopathic ways. And we see this in a number of places, like, you know, male adolescents who might grow up to being empathic people, but when they're talking about girls in the locker room, talk like a bunch of psychopaths. Street gangs. Sometimes in military situations, people can be ruled by a culture of psychopathy. In fact, in the military and battle situations, psychopaths are often the most valued person there. They are the Iceman type. They are the one you want, you know, flying your fighter bomber, who's not going to crack under pressure, because they'll love the excitement. They'll feel no fear, whatever. They tend to live in the present and don't fear consequences. And so we can, a trap we could fall into is a kind of shadow projection, and this is kind of the influence of Jung here, that we all, you know, have a shadow, we have a dark side, and we, because we're uncomfortable with it, we would love to project it onto somebody. Aha, it's the Jews, it's the Nazis, it's the Illuminati, it's the whatever. And I actually saw this starting to happen in some websites that were having forums about psychopathy, including very intelligent ones, is they were starting to segue into that and say, like, okay, well, you see that these Jewish bankers, or you see that these people here...
Hold your thought right there, Jonathan. We're coming up on a hard break. I hate to cut you off, but we've got to go. We'll be right back with Jonathan Zapp, and we'll get farther into it. Hold on to your thought. This is Coast to Coast AM.